This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Try wrapping your mind around this number. 12,544,703,929,352.55. That was the estimate of our national debt when I checked earlier today. I have no idea how they calculated the 55 cents part. You can follow the national debt clock on the Twitter feed of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. My guest, David Walker, is the foundation's president and CEO. Its goal is finding bipartisan solutions for how to decrease our debt. You may know Walker from his appearance in the documentary film IOUSA. Walker had a front row seat as America sank into debt. He was Assistant Secretary of Labor for Pension and Welfare Benefits under President Reagan. Under President George H.W. Bush, he served as one of two public trustees for the Social Security and Medicare systems. And under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush, he was the head of the Government Accountability Office. Walker is also the author of the book, Come Back America, Turning the Country Around and Restoring Fiscal Responsibility. David Walker, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, how has the recession that we're in now contributed to our debt?
People need to understand that there's a fundamental difference between the short-term deficits that we currently face and the structural deficits that represent the real threat. The current deficits are very large. In 2009, $1.42 trillion. For the current year, 2010, an estimated $1.5 to $1.6 trillion. But those were caused largely due to significant declines in revenues because of the recession, because of additional expenditures for social safety net programs, because of two undeclared and unfinanced wars, and a variety of other factors, including bailouts. Those are troubling, and they are adding to our debt at record rates. But that's not what threatens our ship of state. What threatens our ship of state is the structural deficits that will exist after we are out of the recession, after unemployment is down, after the wars are over, and after we get past the current crises.
So when you're talking about the structural deficits, you mean programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, is that what you're talking about?
Well, they're driving the structural deficits, but basically you've got to look at both sides of the ledger. You have to look at the spending side, and the thing that's growing the fastest are health care costs, which would be Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal health care programs. Social Security is growing, but not as fast. But you also have to look at the fact that before we even entered the recession, we were spending more money than we took in. And so we had an imbalance between our revenues and our expenditures even before we had a recession, even before we had these financial institution and housing bailout bills and things of that nature.
I want to get back to those structural deficits a little bit later. Washington is very divided now about how much money to spend on, say, the stimulus program. A lot of people say we haven't spent enough on stimulus and we need to spend more to get the economy going. On the other hand, Republicans seem opposed to spending for stimulus programs. And so I'm wondering, knowing what you know about debt, caring as you do about debt, do you think that a stimulus program in a time like this is something we need to be spending on, or are you just opposed to any more spending because we're already in such debt?
Not all spending is equal. Not all deficits are equal. I think it's understandable to be able to provide some additional unemployment benefits given the fact that unemployment is so high right now. I think it's also potentially acceptable to be able to take some additional steps to try to get unemployment down through timely, targeted, and temporary infrastructure projects that actually will help grow the economy and improve our environmental and other situations, and through targeted tax incentives that will encourage small business and other employers in the private sector to be able to hire people. Those are the kinds of things that might be meritorious. But just spending without targeting or spending to try to be able to prop up unsustainable situations such as the current problems with the states doesn't make sense.
What are you referring to when you say spending on the current problems with the states?
The states have their own fiscal problems, and they're going to need to restructure what they do and how they do business. And in many cases, the states have also grown larger. in government employment levels than they should be. And they've also made promises with regard to their pension and health care programs that are much more lucrative than people get in the private sector. And taxpayers are not going to stand for higher and higher taxes to be able to pay for benefit programs that are much better than the average American gets.
I'm interested in your take on the Obama health care reform plan. And I know the plan isn't completely formulated yet, but from what you know, from what's been proposed so far, how do you think it does in terms of cutting costs?
It doesn't do nearly enough to cut cost. There's absolutely no question that we need comprehensive health care reform. There's also no question in my mind that we need some level of universal coverage in this country that's appropriate, affordable, and sustainable. I would not vote for any health care reform plan unless it meets four tests. It pays for itself over 10 years. It does not add to deficits beyond 10 years. It results in a significant reduction in the tens of trillions of unfunded obligations we already have. And it results in lower health care costs as a percentage of the economy after the passage of the bill than we would have with no bill. The legislation does not meet those four tests.
Now, Republicans passed tax cuts under President Bush. And what did those tax cuts do to America's debt?
There were several rounds of tax cuts that were enacted under George W. Bush's administration. The first one arguably might have been affordable and sustainable, but the two that occurred after that clearly were not. They obviously resulted in lower revenues as compared to what would have been the case had they not been enacted into law, and set us off on a glide path where even before the recession, even before the bailouts, we had a gap between current revenues and current expenditures. And that gap has grown widely after the recession and after the bailouts.
One more spending issue about the Bush administration. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were not only, still are not only very expensive, but when they were first budgeted for, they weren't really in the budget. How was that done?
When the Bush administration first started budgeting for Iraq and Afghanistan, they did so through supplementals, which meant that it wasn't in the base of the budget, and therefore it was something that had to be debated and considered every year, passed separately. Now it is in the base budget. George W. Bush was the biggest spending president in the history of the Republic, but his record is now threatened. George W. Bush almost doubled the national debt during his 8 years as president, but it could double again in the next 8 to 10 years on the current path that we're on. We are clearly on an imprudent and unsustainable path, and we need to change course very soon if we want to recapture our future.
There is an ideology among many Republicans that taxes are bad, that all taxes are bad, and that taxes should just be cut, and you let business and bankers do their thing. No regulations, no taxes. So having witnessed the Great Recession right after all of President George W. Bush's tax cuts, what has become of this theory that taxes are bad, they should just be cut, and that will make us healthier?
Taxes and other forms of revenue are the price of funding government. Government has important roles to play. Some degree of regulation is necessary in order to protect the public interest and to prevent abuse. Reasonable people can and will differ about how they ought to be done, but it clearly needs to be done. With regard to taxes, not all tax cuts stimulate the economy. Very few tax cuts pay for themselves. By that I mean you generate more total revenues after the tax cut than when you would have had you not had the tax cut. The only two that typically do that are dramatic reductions in marginal tax rates and dramatic reductions in tariffs. That's not what we're talking about. In the end, you have to have enough revenues to pay your bills and deliver on the promises that you intend to keep. We're short now, and we're going to get a lot shorter if we don't get our act together.
As the head of the Government Accountability Office, what power, what kind of voice did you officially have in issues like the ones we just talked about?
I could state the facts, speak the truth, but it was not my job ultimately to decide what should be done. I advised the Congress, I advised the President on what I felt was prudent and what was not prudent, but ultimately elected officials are the ones that have to make those decisions. And quite frankly, they made some bad ones.
So when you advised President Bush, did you talk to him directly?
No, I spoke with a number of cabinet-level officials in the Bush administration. Frankly, I did seek a meeting with President Bush when I saw things were totally out of control, but that meeting was not granted. The ultimate irony is that I've met with the current premier of China and the former premier of China at their request. I didn't say anything to them that I hadn't said publicly because it wouldn't have been appropriate. But it's more than a little bit ironic that the Chinese get it more than we do.
What did the Chinese want to talk with you about?
They wanted to talk to me about two issues: the true financial condition of the United States and how to go about transforming government, because I've got a lot of experience in both.
This is a little scary because we need the Chinese to buy our debt, and you're basically saying, oh my God, America's collapsing financially. We're so deep in debt, we're never going to pull out of it. Is that what you told the Chinese?
No, I didn't tell the Chinese anything that I hadn't said publicly. Look,
but you said all what I said is what you've been saying publicly.
No. What I've said is this: we're on an imprudent and irresponsible path. We must start making tough choices sooner rather than later and before we pass a tipping point. Yes, we can do what is necessary in order to help create a better future.
No, you write that when you were the head of the Government Accountability Office during the Bush administration, that the trick was to, quote, turn up my rhetoric without going so far that I sounded crazy. Now, some people say that there's actually deficit hysteria today, that people, and they might put you in that category, that people are just so obsessed with the deficit that it's standing in the way of programs, reform programs that we need to make, like making a start with health care. So I wonder what your reaction to that term deficit hysteria is.
Well, I've made it very clear that not all deficits are equal, that the short-term deficits that we face today are largely explainable because of the recession, two undeclared and two unfinanced wars, a number of extraordinary non-business cycle challenges dealing with financial institutions, insurance concerns, automotive companies, etc. And therefore, that's understandable. I've also made it clear that those deficits may have to go up somewhat in the short term in order to be able to get unemployment down. And if that's the case, so be it. At the same point in time, we need to recognize that what threatens this ship of state is the ice that's below the water in the iceberg. It's not today's $12.4 trillion in debt. It's the $50 trillion in unfunded obligations for Medicare, Social Security, other commitments and contingencies that we don't know how we're going to keep. And it's time to start recognizing that reality and taking steps to make sure that we can deliver on the promises that we intend to keep.
So let's get to the structural changes that you'd like to see. And this has to do with Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. You're not arguing that we do away with any of those programs, right?
Oh, absolutely not. I think it's very important that a country like ours have a strong, sustainable, and secure social safety net. It takes Social Security. I think that's critically important for retirement income security in America. While it wasn't intended to be this way, 22% of Americans rely solely on Social Security for their retirement income, and a majority of Americans rely on it primarily for their retirement income. So I think we need to reform that program to maintain a base-defined benefit system, to provide a stronger benefit or a higher-level benefit for people near the poverty level, somewhat less of a benefit than currently promised for middle and upper income. We need to encourage people to work longer. And we also need to add, on top of a solvent, sustainable, and secure base-defined benefit program, a supplemental savings account that can help to generate additional savings, reduce our reliance on foreign lenders, provide a pre-retirement death benefit, and a supplemental retirement benefit for Americans.
So you're not describing what President Bush wanted, which is transforming Social Security into private savings accounts.
I did not agree with President Bush 43 with regard to his proposed approach to Social Security reform. He was basically trying to convert it from a defined benefit system to a defined contribution system. I do not think that makes sense. You know, he forgot what the second word in Social Security is. It's security, not opportunity.
I keep thinking if our Social Security money was invested in the stock market, what would we have right now?
Well, you know, the other debate that we've had on Social Security is, you know, what do we do with the money in the trust fund? And what about this lockbox concept?
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, the lockbox was picked a long time ago.
How so?
The government spends every dime of the Social Security surplus on other government operating expenses. Every single dime. There's no savings for Social Security. We've issued additional debt that ultimately what happens is we'll have to exchange one form of debt for public debt. And by the way, the government doesn't even want to call the trillions of dollars that it owes Social Security and Medicare a liability. It doesn't want to count it as far as our debt as a percentage of the economy. It wants to make our deficits look smaller than they are because of these funds. And these are all wrong things. This is creative accounting and self-dealing that doesn't make sense.
Do you think Al Gore had it right? There should have been a lockbox?
I think that we should have saved the Social Security surplus and invested it in a responsible manner in order to provide real security for the Social Security promised benefits. But it's too late now because Social Security is now running a negative cash flow. It is paying out more than it takes in. You know, for many years that was not the case, but 2010 is the first year that it is the case. And so it's too late to have that debate.
Now, since we're in such debt and we need money for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, do you think that the President George W. Bush tax cuts should be ended and those taxes should be reinstated?
In my view, the ones that you want to retain are the ones that help to promote savings and investment that can help grow the economy and try to help create a better future. At the same point in time, we have to recognize the reality. The taxes are going to go up, and they're going to go up on a lot more people than those making $250,000 or more. Why? Because of a very simple four-letter word. It's called math. The numbers don't come close to working. My concern is there's two kinds of taxes. There's current taxes and there's deferred taxes. And when you face large, known, and growing deficits, the difference, they basically represent deferred taxes with interest that our kids and grandkids are going to have to pay, absent meaningful and fundamental reforms.
Let's talk about Medicare and Medicaid. What changes would you like to see made in those plans?
Well, in Medicare, I think we have to recognize that it's a very important program geared towards senior citizens, but that there are actually three Medicare programs. There's Medicare Part A, which is hospital insurance, which is funded with a payroll tax, and there's B and D, which are physician and outpayment and prescription drugs, which are voluntary programs funded with a combination of premiums and general revenues and state contributions. The first thing we have to do is recognize that under Medicare Part B and Medicare Part D, billionaires receive subsidies for voluntarily signing up for those programs. That makes no sense. We should have universal opportunity to purchase Medicare Part B and D if you want, but we should have more means-tested premiums than we do right now. There's some means-tested premiums for Medicare Part B. There's not for Part D. We need to have more means-tested for both. We need to also be able to have more competitive bidding with regard to Medicare. We need to move away from the fee-for-service payment system. We need to move more towards evidence-based medicine. We need to do something with regard to malpractice. We need to move to electronic records, more integrated care systems, a number of things that not only apply to Medicare, but also have to apply to our overall healthcare system. And last but certainly not least, we need to learn the lessons of every major industrialized nation. We need a budget for how much taxpayer resources we'll allocate for health care. We're the only major industrialized nation that doesn't do that. Every other country has recognized that it'll bankrupt you if you don't.
Do you sometimes feel like we're becoming a third world country? We have this huge debt. We're dependent on other countries to buy our debt. Our infrastructure is really old and outdated, especially like if you compare some of our infrastructure and some of our transportation system to China's. Do you feel like we're really falling behind? And I don't even mean, just financially, but just looking at our infrastructure, looking at our education system, looking at our public transportation system.
We are a great country, but we're not as great as we think we are. We have a number of people, especially elected officials, who have a false sense of security, who think that because we're currently the only sole superpower on Earth, which, by the way, is temporary, that we must be top three in about everything. That's not the case. We're below average with regard to public finance. We're below average with regard to education results. We're below average with regard to healthcare outcomes. We're below average with regard to the status of our critical infrastructure. We're below average with regard to investments in basic research. All of these are critical elements that help to determine whether or not you're going to have a better future. We need to stop looking in the rearview mirror. We need to look ahead, and we need to look at those leading indicators and start taking steps that will help make sure that we can make tough choices and help ensure that our future will be better than our past.
But that's going to require spending, isn't it, on things like public transportation, education?
Yeah. One of the things that we need to do is first we have to take steps to avoid passing a tipping point, which tipping point would be a loss of confidence on behalf of foreign lenders in our ability to put our federal financial house in order. Government has grown since 1789, much bigger than the founders intended. And in many cases, it just doesn't generate positive results, both on the spending side and on the tax preference side. We lose $1 trillion a year in revenues due to tax preferences, deductions, exemptions, exclusions, credits. It's not in the budget. It's not in the financial statements. And many of them, frankly, just don't work. And so, yes, in some cases, we're going to need to be able to spend more money in order to be able to create a better future. But we just can't layer it on top to what we're already doing, because what we're already doing is unaffordable and unsustainable over time. So we have to start making tough choices to reprioritize, to eliminate, to target, and to be able to give us the ability to do more in areas where it makes sense to do more.
Let me quote you something by the economist James K. Galbraith. And this was in a column that was called In Defense of Deficits. And he wrote, "To focus obsessively on cutting future deficits is a path that will obstruct, not assist, what we need to do to reestablish strong growth and high employment. Private borrowers can and do default. They go bankrupt. With government, the risk of non-payment does not exist. Government spends money simply by typing numbers into a computer. Unlike private debtors, government does not need to have cash on hand. Public debt isn't a burden on future generations. It does not have to be repaid. And in practice, it will never be repaid." What do you think?
I think he's out of touch with reality. You can't spend more money than you make indefinitely without having severe adverse consequences. Under our present path, within 12 years, without an increase in interest rates, the single largest line item in the federal budget is interest on the federal debt. If there is a 2% increase in prevailing interest costs, which many people believe is optimistic, it's going to be worse than that, the only thing the federal government will be able to do in 2035, which is only 25 years from now, based on historical tax levels, is to pay interest on the federal debt. Let's recognize reality. There are three key points with regard to spending. Spending more money than you make on a recurring basis is irresponsible. Irresponsibly spending somebody else's money is unethical, and if you're a fiduciary breach. And irresponsibly spending somebody else's money when they're too young to vote and not born yet is immoral. And all three of those things are going on right now, and they threaten America's future. the decisions that we make or that we fail to make within the next 5 years will largely determine whether our future is better than our past. And in my view, I want it to be better for the sake of my kids and my grandkids.
Just one more thing. It seems to me everybody has words of criticism mm-hmm. for Congress. But is it time to start criticizing Americans, too, individuals?
Great question.
Here's what I mean. It seems to me that, like, Americans, they want health care, they want roads that work, mm-hmm. they want schools mm-hmm. that work, they want a country that works. And at the same time, people don't want to pay taxes. They certainly don't want their taxes raised. But isn't that the only way of funding a government that works and creating highways and roads and public transportation schools that work?
There's no question that people are frustrated with their elected officials and they're complaining about their elected officials. But we also have a societal problem. People are very short-term oriented. They want what they want. They want it now. They don't want to have to pay for it. That doesn't work. And so as a result, we need to recognize the reality that if you want government to be able to do certain things, you have to be willing to pay for it. And that ultimately, if you don't pay for it today, your children and grandchildren are going to pay for it with interest tomorrow. And so we need to have an honest discussion and debate with the American people about how much government do they want and how much are they willing to pay for. And we have to reconcile the gap. And that hasn't been done, but it needs to be done.
David Walker, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Walker is president of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation and author of the book, Come Back America. Breaking Bad, the AMC cable drama series, has been dormant for a while, but it's about to resurface in a big way. Season 2 of the series comes out next week on DVD. And on March 21st, Breaking Bad begins Season 3 on AMC. Our guest is the creator of Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan. The premise of Breaking Bad is about as dark as TV gets. The show's star, Bryan Cranston, has won back-to-back Emmys for his performance. He plays Walter White, a high school science teacher who at the start of the series was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. Worried about his family's future, his wife was pregnant and their teenage son has cerebral palsy, Walter was determined to leave his family with a nest egg. So he decided to use his knowledge of chemistry to manufacture crystal meth and to team up with a former student to sell it. Season 2 of Breaking Bad ended with a mid-air plane collision above Albuquerque, a crash caused indirectly by some of Walter's actions. Season 3 begins 1 week later, with the crash still very much on everyone's minds. Walter's school stages a grief counseling session for the entire student body in the school auditorium. But when Walter takes the microphone, his attempts to soothe the students collide with his personal reliance on cold facts and figures.
I guess what I would want to say is to look on the bright side. First of all, nobody on the ground was killed, and that, I mean, an incident like this over a populated urban center, that right there, that's just got to be some minor miracle. So, plus, neither plane was full. You know, the 737 was what? Maybe two-thirds full, I believe, right? Yes? Or maybe even three-quarters full? Well, at any rate, what you're left with, casualty-wise, is just the 50th worst air disaster.
The creator of Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan, also worked as a writer and producer on The X-Files. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, recorded this interview with Gilligan last month, just as production was ending on the show's third season.
Vince Gilligan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, David.
Let's listen to a scene from the pilot for people who have not seen any of this show before. And this scene, I think, shows the playfulness of the characters and the whole idea of the show, as well as the darkness. This is early on in the pilot, after getting diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, Walter White, who is the character played by Bryan Cranston, decides to use his knowledge of chemistry to cook up some of the purest crystal meth that Albuquerque has ever seen. He steals some equipment from his high school science lab, loads it up in the family hatchback, and takes it over to his new partner, a former slacker student named Jesse, played by Aaron Paul. What I love about this scene that we're about to hear is that Walter is fine with breaking the rules to make and sell illegal drugs. He's justified that. But he's not going to bend the rules when it comes to his lab equipment.
Look at this. Look at this. Keldol-style recovery flask, 800 milliliters.
Very rare. Got your usual paraphernalia, Griffin beakers, your Erlenmeyer flask, but the pièce de résistance, a round-bottom boiling flask, 5,000 milliliters.
Well, I cook him one of those, a big one.
One of these? No, this is a volumetric flask. You wouldn't cook in one of these.
Yeah, I do.
No, you don't. Volumetric flask is for general mixing and titration. You wouldn't apply heat to a volumetric flask. That's what a boiling flask is for. Did you learn nothing from my chemistry class?
No. You flunked me.
Now, with Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul, that's a scene from the pilot of Breaking Bad. One of the things I love as a TV critic and as a viewer when I'm watching television shows that are written well and acted well is that after a couple of episodes, you begin to see that the writers, having seen what the actors are capable of doing, start writing different things for those actors, and there's this synergy that goes on. Am I imagining that as I'm watching it, or can you give a specific example of that actually happening?
No, David, that's very astute. That's actually very true, and that does happen. I can only speak for myself, but that definitely happens with Breaking Bad. I'm sure that does indeed happen with most television shows. And a good example for us would be that my original intention for the character of Jesse Pinkman, played by Aaron Paul, was that Jesse was going to die at the end of season one. And his death would be sort of just in very mechanical plot terms, was going to be an engine for generating great guilt and greatly motivating the character of Walter White in a very dark fashion. And about halfway through the first episode, Aaron Paul, it was so clear to me that this young actor was just a wonderful addition, a wonderful asset to the show, and was going to be a big star, I thought, and was just a great guy to boot, was a wonderful guy to have around, that I quickly changed my mind about killing off this character, and I told him this story. I took him aside one day, and I said, "Hey, guess what, Aaron? I was going to kill you off at the end of the season, but now I'm not because you're so good." But he kind of threw him for a loop a little.
The most surprising thing of season two to me was a moment where we watch Walter White, the Bryan Cranston character, actually allow the girlfriend of Jesse to die basically by choking on her own vomit. And they're Jesse and his girlfriend are both taking heroin at the time, and Walter White stumbles in on them. And he could, as I interpreted it, have saved her merely by turning her over on her side, but instead, because it was convenient to him and she was about to out him as a drug dealer, let her expire. And that was shocking. It was shocking because as a viewer, I was rooting for him to get away with it once I realized that was his intention. It was very much like watching The Sopranos and rooting for Tony and then realizing, oh, wait a minute, he's doing something really despicable here.
Yeah, that was the one moment last season where AMC called me up when they got the – actually, there's a step before the script stage where we outline each episode. In our case, we outline it very in great detail. We write about a 14, 15-page outline sometimes, and we do it primarily to give it to the crew in advance so they have enough prep time. But at that stage, Sony and AMC, you know, read what we have thus far, and they know our intentions at that point in pretty great detail. And at that point, they did indeed get me on the phone, and they said, "Are you sure you want to go here? You realize when you open this door, when you have Walt step through this door, he's never going to be the same after this, and people are going to remember this moment." And I said, "Yeah, we want to remember the moment." They said, "No, but what if it... What if it's what if you take the character someplace bad in relationship to the viewers, and you can't return? You know, once you do this, you can't ever return from it. And we talked about it for a long time. And I have to be honest, the original version I had in my head was that he actually shoots her up with a little extra dose of heroin, so he's a little more active in his. Culpability concerning her death, but
that's where I draw the line.
I am glad I get talked out of that because in the heat of the moment, you probably have a tendency to want to take things a little too far. I know I did, and I'm glad I got talked out of that.
I understand that you came to cast Bryan Cranston as the lead in your show because of a performance that he gave on one of your previous shows when you were a producer on The X-Files.
Yes, that is correct.
And so what I'd like to do is play a fast clip from that and have you sort of deconstruct it and tell me what was impressive about his performance to you. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Okay. Bryan Cranston plays a man named Crump, a paranoid farmer, but an understandably paranoid one, with a killer headache, whose wife, who also had the same sort of headache, recently died when her head suddenly exploded. In this scene, Crump has forced Fox Mulder, played by David Duchovny, to drive him and drive fast while Crump sits in the back seat with a gun pointed at Mulder's head. Crump is fighting the pain and telling the story of trying to rush his wife to the hospital. If you think about it, it's sort of like the movie Speed, except it's the head that's going to explode, not the bus.
She starts screaming. I didn't know what the hell to do. I got her in the truck and taken her to the hospital. But then it seemed like the faster we went, the better she'd do. But just as soon as I tried to slow down or stop,
I'm sorry about your wife.
Sure you are. You and the rest of your Jew FBI.
Crump.
Oh, yeah. You think I don't know, huh? You think I'm just some ignorant puttknucker, don't you? But I get it, man. I see what this is. I am not sick, and I did not have the flu. Vicky and me were just some kind of government guinea pigs.
You think the government did this to you?
Hell yeah. Who else? You see it all the time on the TV. They're dropping Agent Orange. They're putting radiation in little retarded kids' gonads. Oh, yeah. Sons of bitches sneaking around my woods at night. I seen you. You think I don't know?
Well, on behalf of the International Jewish Conspiracy, I just need to inform you that we're almost out of gas.
Now, what was it about Bryan Cranston, whom most viewers will know as the dad in Malcolm in the Middle? So, you know, he's a sitcom actor in one sense, and yet he is so much more. What was it about him that stood out to you?
Well, I was fortunate enough to not know who Bryan Cranston was when he came in and read for us back for that episode of The X-Files. And I say that ironically somewhat, but this was about 18 months before Malcolm in the Middle went on the air. And we were having a hard time casting that part for that role of Mr. Crump there, because what we knew we needed was a great actor who could be scary and very intense and deliver a lot of really horrible, nasty, hateful lines like the ones you just heard.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as nasty as he is, nonetheless, you want to feel bad for him when he expires at the end of the episode. And we knew we needed an actor who could pull all of that off. It wasn't just a matter of wonderful acting. It was a little more to it as well. And our casting director in The X-Files brought in Bryan Cranston to read at the end of a long, several days' worth of auditions. We had read a lot of very wonderful actors who had the acting chops, but who somehow they're missing that extra little something that made them very, you know, that made you want to root for them, I guess is the best way to put it. And Brian walked in on the last day of our auditions and just nailed it, just crushed it, and was just so wonderful, just was the guy right from the moment he sat down and started reading the lines. And I looked to the other producers with this sort of gleeful look and whispered OTW to them, which is our slang for off to work, which is what you say or what you whisper to each other when you know that the guy is being hired right in the room, whether at that moment he knows it or not. About 18 months later, when Malcolm in the Middle came on, I remember watching the pilot and realizing it was the same guy. And Brian, by the way, is a true chameleon of an actor, in my opinion. This is a guy. He played Buzz Aldrin in From the Earth to the Moon. He played the one-armed officer in Saving Private Ryan, who sends Tom Hanks and his men on their mission. He was the dentist on Seinfeld that converts to Judaism for the jokes. You know, he's a guy in everything that he does. He looks like a different person. You often it takes you a while to realize from one project to another that you're looking at the same guy. I mean, he's really immerses himself into a role.
We're speaking with TV writer-producer Vince Gilligan, creator of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad, which is just starting its third season. Among the themes of Breaking Bad, I would guess among the major themes, are that families are very complicated, and actions having consequences is my favorite thing about Breaking Bad, because at the end of each hour, I expect, okay, you've gone there, he's done that, he's killed a person or he's done this other thing, and then we'll forget about it next week. We never forget about it next week. And even this new third season begins only 1 week after the shocking end to last season. It's so novelistic and so linear. Is that easy to write? Is that harder to write?
It is very hard to write, but very challenging and very satisfying. And I'm so glad that you like the that is one of my favorite things about the show as well, and something we work very hard toward, the idea that actions have consequences. We never really let things drop on our show. And yes, indeed, when Walt kills someone, it sticks with him. And when Walt lies to someone, that lie continues to exist and it becomes kind of a little landmine that will eventually blow up under his feet, perhaps, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 episodes later. As a television viewer my whole life, that was something that always struck me as a little false about a lot of television shows, that actions sort of exist in a vacuum. And of course, you know, we know in real life that we carry around our actions throughout life sort of like luggage. You know, they stick with us forever, good and bad. And you know, back to the television not typically being like that, that's another issue about what Breaking Bad is trying to be versus other shows. Television as a medium is all about protecting the franchise. In other words, when you're watching MASH, which is a show I've seen every episode of, I loved MASH, but MASH is a show in which, you know, a 2.5 year police action in Korea gets stretched into 12 years, 11 years long, 11 seasons. A typical TV show is all about protecting the franchise. It's all about stretching it out for as long as you can stretch it out, and it's all about taking the characters in any given hour as far as you can take them, but then resetting them more or less back to zero so that at the beginning of the next week, they're still the character you know and love, you know, the character Mulder or Archie Bunker or whoever that you tune in, you saw go through some changes last week. He or she is still that person fundamentally without much change involved that you've been tuning into for years on end. Because it exists so much in that state currently, television does. I wanted to do something different with Breaking Bad and make it indeed a story from of a character going from A to Z. But this really wants to be, this show Breaking Bad wants to be a show truly about transformation, where the character you tuned into to watch in the first episode is a guy you would not even recognize come the end of the entire season. You wouldn't even realize you're looking at the same guy.
Well, Vince Gilligan, thanks for making a great TV series that's an awful lot of fun to watch, and also thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, David. Appreciate it.
Vince Gilligan is the creator of the AMC series Breaking Bad, which begins its third season March 21st. Season 2 comes out on DVD next week. Gilligan spoke with Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli, who writes TVWorthWatching.com and is the author of the book Dangerously Funny, the uncensored story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.